The last matter on calendar today is Alaska Community Action on Toxics, International Union United Automobile, Aerospace, and Agricultural Implement Workers, and versus United States Environmental Protection Agency. And the actual case numbers are 25-158, 25-572, and 25-573. So we'll take a moment to get situated here. I know we've got a lot of, we have someone on video. We've got a lot of moving parts. So don't break a hip running here. So now it looks to me like the petitioners in this matter the petitioner that's on video, is that Randy Sue Renowitz? All right, good morning. I can't hear you, but anyway, so, and you represent the union, is that correct? You're muted. Okay, good. All right. Now, you've divided your time, but it's all on the appellant's side. So have you decided who's going first?
I don't think we've made a decision, but I was told this morning maybe by...
I can't hear you.
Oh, excuse me. Is this better?
Better.
Okay.
Project.
Thank you. I believe we were told that we would be going first. We're the environmental petitioners. Happy to do so. But...
I'm not
happy to defer to the court's preference.
Go first, but if you you're planning to go first,
we're here and we're happy. I'm happy to.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Is that okay with you, Ms. Rabinowitch? Okay. So you have 15. You have 10. Are you?
I think we reserve 15. Or we have.
Who's going to do rebuttal?
We're separate cases on separate petitions, so...
Okay, so you're each going to tell us how much you want to say on rebuttal?
That's right.
Okay. All right. Is that okay with you, then? Okay. And you'll tell me when you come to the podium how much you want to reserve of your time. But you are sort of dividing... We gave 25 minutes the way that we said that. So I just want to tell the second person... and that would be Ms. Rabinowitz. If we're asking a lot of questions of Sagar? Sagar. If we're asking a lot of questions of him, I'm not counting that against you. So don't worry that you have no that he's taking up all your time. Okay, you'll get your 10 minutes. Okay, so you don't have to burst in and tell him to stop. All right. So, okay, we're ready to start then.
Thank you and good morning.
My
name is Tosh Sagar. I'm here on behalf of petitioners Alaska Community Action on Toxics, whose members are here with us, and the Environmental Defense Fund. At table with me is my co-counsel, Sam Lisko, from the Environmental Defense Fund. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
In this case, EPA has taken a minor exemption provision meant for very low-risk chemicals to allow the worst of the worst chemicals to quickly enter the market and avoid the standard review process that Congress set as the default. Congress laid out this standard review process in great detail in Section 2604. It requires rigorous review and ensures that protections are tailored to the unique risks of each chemical. Then, in a minor subprovision, Congress gave authority to EPA to exempt very low-risk chemicals, those that conclusively will not present an unreasonable risk. But EPA knows PBTs aren't low-risk. In this rulemaking, EPA found that PBTs are intrinsically risky at any level of exposure. Nevertheless, EPA took authority meant for low-risk chemicals and determined it could be used for risky PBTs. That counterintuitive approach...
Explain to me what are the practical consequences of allowing a manufacturer of a new PBT to apply for an exemption rather than barring all PBTs from the exemptions?
Yeah, so the practical consequences are as follows. EPA has said that the exemption process is less comprehensive, it's less detailed, and that it can't use the same level of tools, restrictions that are available in the standard review process. And those are restrictions that are tailored to the individual chemical to ensure it won't present unreasonable risk. So you could think about something like a chemical that you could put in a landfill, but you can't put it in an incinerator. EPA cannot do that through the exemption process. It can only do that through the standard review process. And here, in the years, we know in the years leading up to this, the chemical companies in the record said that they were using these exemption processes to get new PBTs through. They've said in the record that the exemption processes are good to get highly toxic chemicals through and approved that couldn't get approved through the standard process. And so that's the real problem here.
Must the EPA make an affirmative determination that a new PBT, quote, will not present an unreasonable risk of injury to the health of the environment? What happens to an application if the EPA cannot make an affirmative determination within a certain period of time or at all? So do they have to make that determination here?
I think I would separate out two questions. One, do they have to make it at the rulemaking stage in this rulemaking and then at the application level? And our answer is yes to both, but I also want to say reserve that we think there's a way to resolve this without addressing that question. But on the question of do they have to make the finding in the rulemaking? The answer is yes. EPA has said so in every prior rulemaking where it created or modified an exemption. EPA said it had to make a statutorily mandated finding, a general finding that categories that were eligible for the exemption will not present an unreasonable risk. They said that when they made these exemptions starting in 1985 and in every subsequent prior rule until this one. So that's EPA's own prior interpretation of the statute. I think we lay that out most clearly at our reply brief in pages like 9 through 12. You can see rulemaking after rulemaking where they've made this general finding. Again, I think there's a narrow way, if the court doesn't want to tackle that statutory question, to resolve this case in our favor. I think relying solely on EPA's record findings and concessions, and if I could start there, because I think,
of course, it just doesn't. If we're saying these are the most toxic, and then what is it, 30 days on those exemptions, and it's 90 days on other things, and apparently, and then we have the discussion of the low volume and the low exposure exemptions. You know, I think all of us would be concerned on, you know, what the parade of horribles, as you're saying, is somehow that this will allow terrible, dangerous things to kill everyone. But the EPA has to make a determination of dangerousness at some point. Where does that happen? I'm going to ask them too. So they're going to think about what their answer is. So maybe I'm trying to understand how this is happening.
Yeah, so maybe I can start with the practical, what we know has been happening, and then turn to the like formalistic. So EPA says in the rule or in their brief at 10 that they're formalizing the status quo. Let me tell you what the status quo was. The chemical industry in their comments said, we are using these. We are using these across all sectors of the economy for new PBTs. Our standing declaration identifies dozens of PBTs. The status quo prior to this rule was a de facto status quo in which EPA was approving these, and EPA formalized that status quo into this de jure rule, and that de jure rule will now allow the ongoing approval of new PBT chemicals that will get out into the market and expose our clients. So I think that's the problem, that they're saying everything is fine, don't worry, but if you look at what they were doing immediately before, they were in fact allowing these new toxic PBTs onto the market. And so that's a problem. And what we think is, as a formalistic matter, how do you think about how this statute should work? There's an exemption process. EPA creates rules. Those rules are like a screen. They create eligibility criteria, like a test that presumptively establishes that chemicals that meet the eligibility criteria are low risk in advance. And then individually, it looks for characteristics at the individual chemical application level. Is there something that tells us that presumption is wrong? You can think about like a medical diagnostic test. You go in, you get your cholesterol taken. If you're below a number, let's say 125, you're probably at low risk, but the doctor doesn't stop there. It looks at the individual criteria. Do you smoke? Do you exercise? To say maybe that bumps you up to high risk or not. And the problem here is that EPA has taken a number, 10,000 kilograms for the LVE, for example. That tells for a non-PBT chemical, maybe it's fair to say that presumptively establishes its low risk. That's not true for a PBT chemical. EPA has never found that that's true for a PBT chemical. And it's still allowing them through. And then these individual regulatory provisions require affirmative evidence, a determination that there's some additional evidence of risk, even though EPA can't say they're presumptively low risk.
But what sense are going to do a case by, go ahead.
I mean, why is this just not the case from Loper-Bright, where the court says sometimes the best reading of the statute is that it delegates to the agency to determine these questions?
So I think, again, I want to distinguish between kind of what's going on in the rule and what's going on at the application stage. I think if you're asking what is required in the rule,
it sounds like you're asking us to second guess EPA's determination that these PBTs are not unreasonable risk of potential exposure. But I mean, it seems like the statute delegates it to the administrator to determine that.
We're not asking you to second guess this, and I think that's where I really want to focus on what I think
is. What are you asking us to do?
I think you can take their finding in the rule, and this is at our excerpt of record 249, where they say PBTs inherently, when there's exposure, there is risk. There are serious adverse effects, which is equivalent to risk. And this, they say that. That's their finding. And this provision, the new fast track provision, allows them to approve chemicals where there's some level of exposure. And that just that doesn't match up. They're saying if there's any exposure in the rulemaking, they found if there's any.
Are there other provisions that if it's exposure that leads to dangerousness to the health or the environment, then doesn't meet the criteria for the exemption?
No, there's another provision that says if there's evidence of serious adverse effects.
Right.
Right. And I think that's typically about sort of like health studies. But if that were right, even if your premise were right, then this new provision does nothing. And that just doesn't make sense.
Why? I mean, the way I understand it is that the EPA has made a determination that it's possible that some PBTs exist that are just don't lead to a risk of injury and health to the environment. And so therefore they're exempt from the lengthy review process.
I don't think that's the right way to understand this. I think what EPA has said in this provision, 723.50(d)(2), it says if EPA determines that a chemical is PBT with unanticipated releases and unreasonable exposures, then it can deny it. The implication is if there isn't evidence on exposures or there is evidence that there's some exposure but it's not unreasonable, EPA can approve it. But in the record, EPA said that if there are any exposures, that it should be denied. And EPA, but that's not what the rule says. And so there's a mismatch between their finding in the record that any exposure is risky.
They say that, I mean, in most cases, they're not going to get approved for this exemption. And isn't that what kind of accounts for that?
I think there are two things I would say there. Historically, and in this rule itself, EPA has said when we can't say that most cases, when we think for a category of chemicals that most cases will disapprove them, they just make them ineligible. That's what they did for the PFAS chemicals here, right? They said the same thing. They said most of the time PFAS won't meet the test. We're not saying 100% of PFAS won't meet the unreasonable risk standard, but we're going to still make all of them ineligible. But
they are making an unreasonable risk assessment.
If you're asking, did they make a formal unreasonable risk assessment in this rule, they did not. What they've done in prior rules was they did a technical risk analysis. That's not here. They don't claim it's here. We pointed that out. Then they made a formalized finding. The category of chemicals, as a general matter, will not present unreasonable risk. That's at page 11 of our brief where we documented. They made that formal finding over and over. They did not make that here. But again, I don't think you need to answer this sort of broader statutory question about what kind of findings do they need to make in the rule. It's clear that their rule contemplates that they will approve PFAS that could result in some quantum of exposure, but their finding was that any quantum of exposure should lead to a denial. So there's a mismatch. It's overbroad. If you say, look, they said certain things should, the PFAS, or excuse me, PBTs with some exposure should be denied. The rule allows for PBTs with some exposure. That's arbitrary. And they say in their brief, if there's absence of information on exposure, that should also lead to a denial. That's not codified in the rule anywhere. Those two things.
Sounds like, so why isn't your argument just premature? Like, you're saying that there's a possibility they would approve something that might lead to exposure. But why don't we just wait for that to happen, and then you could file an injunction or something at that point? It just, why throw out the rule when there's no obvious violation in the rule itself?
I think three responses. Yeah. The rule is obviously violative. It allows things that are either, you could say, at a statutory level shouldn't be allowed, or that are arbitrary. But then practically, right, I think it's incredibly difficult to go play whack-a-mole. There are hundreds of these every year. There are hundreds of chemical applications every year. 75% of them, the identity of the chemical is secret. You couldn't even tell if they're PBTs.
But I thought none of them are approved, right?
No, I mean, as the chemical companies demonstrate, as we've demonstrated, there have been approvals in the dozens of approvals in the years leading up to this, and we can expect more. But there's a formalistic response, which is Congress expressed a preference for us to challenge rules, right? This is an exemption process by rule, and in Section 2016-18, which is the judicial review provision, Congress said, bring your challenges within 60 days to rules. Congress wanted regulatory certainty, so everyone had the rules of the road in front of them. Yes, I intend.
Doesn't that lead to an Article 3 injury question? So you're not saying you're injured by the rule now. You're injured by the possibility that a rule will be applied and allow an exemption for a PBT that might lead to an exposure that then would potentially lead to an injury to your organization. Is that your Article 3 injury?
I think we have three distinct Article 3 injuries that we've argued. Associational standing based on sort of the deprivation of the statutory protections. They're taking things out of the standard review process and putting these PBTs through the expedited process. That's safer, this court's decision in Safer Chemicals. Weakening the statutory protections is an injury, Article 3 injury.
Second, to your organization?
To our members, our associate. That was an associational standing case involving these very same plaintiffs.
Okay.
I think NRDC 2013 decision and the Association of Irritated Residents decision, credible threat standard, plausibility of future exposure is sufficient. Here, the chain of causation is uncontested and fully established. Will manufacturers use these exemptions? They did before. This just ratifies the status quo. They'll continue to do so. Will we be exposed? We have unrebutted expert declarations from scientists who study the PBT problem, including a former EPA scientist who is responsible for new chemicals, saying that our members will be exposed to these things. So I don't think there's any question as to jurisdiction, and that's why EPA didn't challenge our jurisdiction or standing. Thank you so much.
Okay, so you don't have any time left, but I'm going to give you 2 minutes.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Do we want the union to go next and then have the union go next?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We're going to hear, I was just consulting amidst my colleagues here that we'll have, even though they're sort of distinct issues, we'll have Ms. Rabinowitz for the union go next.
Thank you.
Can you answer for me, does the 2024 rule change the union's access to PMNs in any meaningful way? If so, how? So let me ask you, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and if you can answer them together, because there, if we were to hypothetically to agree with your argument, the union's argument, is the appropriate remedy a remand to the EPA to allow it to consider the merits of your objections? And then the other thing is, if we were to affirm the EPA's determination that the union's proposal was beyond the scope of rulemaking, which I think is the argument of the EPA, do the unions have any other ways to bring their concerns to the EPA's attention? Okay, so you can understand. I mean, obviously, you've listened, and we have this whole other issue that really kind of has nothing to do with you, but it's all part of this. So I suppose we could hypothetically on one side say that, which of, I'm sure that the other petitioner would not like this, but I'm not, we could hypothetically say that the EPA, it's fine on their part, but then remand and say, answer the unions how they're supposed to, be able to get access, or how are they going to do this? But you're what you would like are separate likes here. They're essentially separate. Okay.
The argument from the EPA is that your proposed rule is unresponsive to their proposed rule. I mean, what's the nexus to the rule that we're reviewing? Okay. We think they have not been able to.
that EPA will be required to add to its form. And also at 40 CFR 720.78, it lists the information that EPA was going to include in the federal register. But one of the things that the union asked for is for EPA to include location information. Because if I'm working at a factory, I'm not really interested in all PFAS. I'm interested in the PFAS that are going to be manufactured at the ABC company in XYZ town. And so the unions don't necessarily have the same interest in sort of PBTs or PFAS generally. They have a more direct focused interest in the PBTs at their workplace that they may be exposed to.
Okay, thank you. You're down to 2.5 minutes. Do you want to reserve? Thank you. All right, we'll hear from the EPA. Good morning. Good
morning. May it please the court. Kristen Sarna on behalf of respondent EPA. The court should deny environmental petitioners and labor petitioners petitions for review. These petitions raise only narrow challenges to EPA's 2024 new chemical rule. However, the rule is reasonable. It is supported by the record.
Stand closer to the microphone so I can hear you.
Absolutely. Is this better?
Better.
The rule is reasonable. It is supported by the record, and it is consistent with the statute. This rule concerns EPA's longstanding exemption for low-volume and low-exposure chemicals from EPA's standard new chemical manufacturing review process. And I think it's important to keep that context in mind, that this is an exemption for low-volume and low-exposure chemicals. So this isn't just any chemical can qualify to be considered for the exemption, but rather EPA has determined, and I think it is a somewhat common sense thinking that, for example, if you have a small volume of a chemical, the risk is going to be smaller than if you have a large volume.
Some things, just a little teeny bit's enough. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you hear out one pill kills, okay, with fentanyl. I mean, there's some, a little bit isn't, low volume doesn't protect. And so that what I was trying to figure out here is the EPA and PBTs are generally considered to be dangerous, right?
I think generally, yes, that is correct.
Okay, I know I'm being overly general, perhaps. But where in this process are we sure that even though you're doing low volume and, you know, all of that, that you're protecting? You know, is there any, what's the protection here?
Absolutely. I think there are quite a few protections put in place, and it's helpful to maybe keep in mind the context of how EPA is going to go about granting these exemptions. And I'm happy to read some language from the Federal Register notice and the final rule, where EPA explained that in order to effectuate these amendments for individual exemption notices, EPA would first need to review the exemption notice to determine if the substance is a PBT, and then review the environmental releases and exposures to humans or environmental organisms to determine if releases and exposures are expected. Only after EPA has reviewed the hazards and exposures will EPA then make a decision to either grant or deny the exemption request.
And is there anywhere in here, though, where EPA will make a determination that it doesn't present an unreasonable risk to the injury or health of the environment?
Absolutely. I think that is the standard for granting an exemption. So in order to grant this, to grant the exemption, there has to be a finding about that. And I think also with respect to PBT specifically, EPA is going to have to consider if they have anticipated environmental releases and potentially unreasonable exposures. And in this rule specifically, EPA got rid of kind of this understanding that companies had that they, if they met that 30-day mark and EPA hadn't issued an exemption about, or a decision for the exemption application, the company could go ahead and manufacture under the exemption. EPA made clear, you need an affirmative decision from us before you can begin manufacturing. And so that makes really clear, EPA is going to have to sit down, it's going to have to look at this application, it's going to have to evaluate the exposures, evaluate the risks. And I think inherent in environmental petitioners' argument is a criticism that EPA is going to approve applications for PBTs that are risky. And what they're asking the court to do is assume that EPA is not going to comply with the terms of this rule. And we would strongly urge the court not to do so. EPA has issued this rule, intends to comply with this rule. And if there is a specific determination that environmental petitioners take issue with, they should bring a challenge related to that specific determination, which is final agency action and would be reviewable in a court. And this isn't the proper forum for environmental petitioners to raise hypothetical challenges about a PBT that could be approved.
As I understand your friend's argument is that because the way the rules are written, there's a possibility that an application can be approved that does lead to an exposure. Why doesn't the rules just preclude any exposure?
You're asking why the rule doesn't exclude.
Right. I mean, it seems like his concern would be alleviated if the rules, like flatly say, that no application would be approved if there is an exposure.
I'm not saying that EPA doesn't necessarily have the authority to do that
yes.
if it wanted to, but I do think that reads the importance of the exemption out of the statute. Like Congress contemplated a statutory framework where EPA might sit down and decide that certain categories of chemicals could be exempted from the standard pre-manufacturing review process because EPA determines they're not going to present an unreasonable risk. And EPA determined that chemicals and, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I guess the question I have is there some exposures that EPA can determine that are not a risk of health, of risk of injury to the health or the environment?
Are you, to clarify, are you asking about like a hypothetical PBT?
Correct. Is there any, because it does seem like if any PBT that's exposed to the environment or to people is dangerous, then why can't you just categorically say that if that happens, then we're not going to approve? Or the possibility would be, well, there's some PBTs that an exposure won't be dangerous.
I don't have to answer the first part of that. I don't have a specific chemical that I could point
okay.
you too, and say this chemical would get its application approved. But I do just want to back up a step and kind of take into account the statutory framework of this. This concerns new chemicals. And so EPA isn't going to necessarily have all the information about a chemical that might be, a company might come to it in 5 years and say, we want to manufacture this chemical. And so rather what EPA is doing is kind of setting out the framework for once it gets an exemption application, what are we going to look at? What are we going to consider? And EPA has explained that this is kind of its longstanding process. And so what it's doing here by providing this information about, just so all of you manufacturers know, when we get an application for a PBT, here's what we're going to consider. Let's provide some clarity so that companies who have a PBT, who they know that there are going to be exposures, they don't waste their time submitting an application. EPA doesn't waste its time evaluating. EPA is just providing additional clarity for an exemption that has been in place for over 20 years at this point, and EPA has been considering PBTs on a case-by-case basis. It's just providing additional information about what it's going to consider when it sits down and looks at those applications.
I just one historical question. There were argument that this rule is just codifying the status quo, but then there's a question that I think the other side was saying that no PBT had ever been no exemption has ever been approved.
Yes,
is that
and
correct?
It's a little weird, unclear yeah. to me from environmental petitioners' remarks today, and based on their briefing, there seems to be kind of a contrast, saying we couldn't identify a PBT that would meet these standards, but then we have approved PBTs. And I don't have a specific answer because I don't have the information about the chemicals that they're pointing to specifically to be able to get the EPA program involved to figure out what they're disagreeing about.
But you don't know if whether or not PBTs have ever been approved for an exemption?
I don't have the information available right now, but I think I would keep in mind that it's our position that it isn't necessarily the approval or denial of the applications that is important. It's EPA's ability to consider the application. And so it's whether EPA has to affirmatively reject the application no matter what because a chemical is a PBT or if EPA is allowed to kind of sit down and look at the PBT. And I think it might be helpful to circle back to the PFAS exclusion that was mentioned by environmental petitioners because I think that kind of demonstrates why PBTs might be a little bit different. And they said that PFAS were excluded categorically because EPA made a determination about how dangerous and how risky PFAS were, and they needed to exclude them. And that's, in fact, not true at all with what happened in the statute. I think, as important context to keep in mind, how a PFAS is determined, whether a chemical is a PFAS, is just based on its molecular structure. So there's a very clear definition for what is a PFAS and what isn't. And so a chemical before applying. So do you have a question?
No.
Okay.
I would ask you to speak a little bit more slowly because I'm losing some of what you're saying.
Absolutely. Sorry about that, Your Honor.
You are racing, and then, of course, you're using your
PFOS, this, that, or two. So just keep that in mind.
Yes, Your Honor. My apologies. This is a little bit complicated of a topic. But to clarify about...
I understand if you slow down and sometimes less, you know, more just say it as opposed to give the abbreviation.
Yes, Your Honor. Circling back to, so the PFOS chemicals, a category of chemicals, it's based on their molecular structure. So it's a pretty simple, we're checking a box, yes or no. Do we meet the molecular definition for is this chemical a PFOS? And so a company, when they're submitting the application, they're going to know. They're going to know if they have a PFOS or they're going to know if it's not. And PBTs aren't the same. PBTs involve a complicated analysis by EPA where it scores the chemical based on three different criteria. That's the persistence, bioaccumulativeness, and the toxicity, and that's what PBT stands for. And so EPA has to get into the weeds. It has to look at the application. It has to sit down and evaluate the hazards and exposures from this chemical, inherent in even deciding if the chemical is a PBT or not. And while some manufacturers might have an idea of whether or not their chemical is a PBT, they're not going to know until they've actually submitted the application to EPA. And so when EPA made the determination about PFOS, it decided because of the scientific complexities and the difficulties it had in looking at these applications, it wasn't going to be making a decision, able to make a decision within 30 days. And so it found because it was just in a complicated analysis, it decided to exclude the PFOS from this exemption. But it didn't make the same determination about PBTs. And that's not to say in some cases EPA won't have the necessary information and will have to deny the exemption application, but EPA reserved the right to consider the PBT exemption applications on a case-by-case basis.
30 days, if it's not accompanied with the determination that that it's not going to cause injury to health or environment, just because the 30 days go by and maybe all you've done is open the file, they don't get the exemption. Is that correct?
I'm not sure that EPA can later affirmatively grant the exemption. I think what was changed in the rule.
But I think you said people were saying previously, if you don't act within 30 days, that presumptively we can go ahead.
Yeah. So you're correct that it did change. You have to have an affirmative determination from EPA before you can begin manufacturing.
So if you don't get it done in 30 days, they just can't say, okay, well, we can just go ahead because they didn't say anything.
That is correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Do you ever get them done in 30 days?
I'm not sure. I don't have that information available to me.
I think that kind of tells me maybe you don't, but okay, go ahead.
I think there are a lot of administrative burdens involved in this, absolutely. I just want to clarify one more time that there isn't a presumption of eligibility. That's not what this rule did. It didn't create a presumption that PBTs would affirmatively be eligible unless EPA made a decision. Rather, it set forth the things that EPA has to consider if the PBT qualifies, and EPA has said it's probably rare, this is probably unlikely that a PBT will qualify, but if it does...
The practical effect prior to this rule, what process would a PBT go through?
So manufacturers would still be eligible to submit their chemical for this same process for the exemption application, and EPA would consider the parts of the rule requiring the eligibility. So if it meets the exposure requirement.
What's the purpose of the change? Obviously, what is different now with this exemption process that didn't exist before? What is the change?
I would say it's a clarification of policy and not a change of practice. EPA is clarifying what it considers, and we think that the clarity and transparency provided by this is important for manufacturers to know when they submit what EPA is going to consider. And we think this might save some of the administrative burden for PBTs that clearly don't meet the requirements that they may not.
Did you do the exact same thing before this
rule? Yes, EPA... PBTs were eligible for consideration for the exemption before this rule. This rule simply codified an additional basis that wasn't written in the rule before for how EPA would disqualify or deny the applications for PBTs.
Did the time change? When the exemptions, how quickly were the exemptions done
The 30-day requirement, I believe that comes from the statute, but what EPA did was say that once the 30 days expire, that doesn't affirmatively make someone eligible for the exemption. They need a written decision from EPA.
So we do have the other challenge. Unless my colleagues want to linger here, maybe you can go to the...
We lost.
Uh-oh.
Oh,
you're back. Okay, we lost you for a second. Are you hearing everything, Ms. Rabinowitz? Okay. All right, because we're moving to the salient part of your argument here. So it appears that the 2024 rule amended the regulations concerning the publication of pre-manufacture notices. Why were the union's comments outside the scope of the rulemaking? Because I think you heard, I sort of formed this, that your friend on the other side is basically saying, if they don't talk now, forever hold your peace. They have nowhere else to complain. But then you're saying, you know, I mean, judges like people to complain at the right time. But if they can never complain, you know, no remedy doesn't seem appropriate. So do you want to address that?
Absolutely. There seem to be kind of two questions inherent in what you're saying. And I want to address the first part of that, and that's whether or not this is their only forum to bring this complaint, because I think this is a really important thing to keep straight. And that's that this is not their only forum, that they have this avenue called a petition for rulemaking. If you want EPA to consider a specific course of action, you can file a petition. You can set forth all the information. Here's why we think this new regulatory regime about disclosure, about confidential information, should be considered. And that is important because then commenters aren't trying to piggyback off of a rule somewhat unrelated provisions. That would result in, you know, take for example, had EPA adopted these provisions that were suggested by the labor petitioners, all of the companies, the ones who would actually be subject to these requirements, had no opportunity to comment on these requirements. They had no opportunity to tell us whether or not they thought this was a good idea or a bad idea to require the manufacturers themselves to provide this information to individual employees or provide confidential information that is expressly protected by the statute. So there's a lot of reasons why we don't want to just extend every rulemaking up to any issue that might be somewhat tangentially related because it concerns the same statutory framework or uses a similar word like disclosure. So I think that is kind of important context to keep in mind, that if these petitioners wanted EPA to consider whether or not it should create new disclosure requirements, that they have an avenue to do so. And EPA would have to issue a decision laying out its reasons why or why not, and considering its statutory authority, considering comments from or considering other interests that might be involved here, instead of piggybacking off of a different rule that doesn't concern these specific issues.
So you're saying EPA must respond to petition for rulemaking?
I believe so. I'm not entirely sure off the top of my head, but yes.
So they made comments at the time, right? And the EPA did not respond to the comments?
EPA didn't respond to the comments on the merits. So in its response to comments, EPA acknowledged the comments, acknowledged that it had received them, but said that they were outside the scope of the rulemaking. And so because of that, it wasn't going to respond to the comments on the merits. And if it's helpful, I would like to kind of point to the specific changes that EPA made in this rule that relate to the disclosure provisions, because I think that's helpful in showing why labor petitioners' comments are outside the scope of what EPA was dealing with. And so there were kind of two discrete changes that were related to notice and disclosure requirements. And so that's EPA clarified its practice of publishing notice of a receipt of a pre-manufacture notice in the Federal Register once the notice is complete. So not when the notice is received, when the notice is complete, EPA is going to publish it. It made that clarification. And then it removed a non-statutory requirement to publish a list of certain data submitted with the pre-manufacture notice in the Federal Register. And so those kind of two specific discrete changes were what EPA was considering. And that's information that the manufacturer submits to EPA. And what labor's comments were raising was what the manufacturer is telling its employees. And so what obligation the manufacturer has to post things in the workplace or get them to sign something saying that they've received. And so EPA was only talking about information manufacturers submitted to EPA and what EPA did with the information, not what manufacturers are required to do with respect to their employees. That's a completely different subject and kind of a whole new regulatory framework that EPA would need to think through if it has a statutory authority to do that, what that would look like. And that's not taking a position on whether or not that's a good idea, whether or not that should be done, whether or not the individuals need more notice about the chemicals that they're working with. We're not trying to say necessarily that these ideas are bad or that EPA will never consider them. We're trying to say that this isn't the proper vehicle for their consideration, and the court shouldn't be getting involved in these issues because they're not put forth in this proposed rule and then what EPA ended up finalizing. So this isn't what EPA solicited comments on. I'm happy to take further questions if the court has them, but I'm also happy to yield the rest of my time.
I don't think we have any more questions. Okay.
Thank you all.
Okay. So we'll go back to the community action on toxics, and I think I gave you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to make 3 quick points if I could. In terms of what's happening on the ground, these exemptions are being used prior to this rule and will be used after this rule to approve toxic new PBTs inappropriately. To clarify, from 2014 to 2017, our position was EPA categorically rejected PBT exemptions. That's at ER 226 in a footnote. That's all we said for that period. Then something changed. The chemical industry said in their comments, we're using these exemptions. That's at the further excerpts of record 16 to 17. We've identified dozens of such applications. That's at the DOA declaration, paragraphs 39 and 40. And my friend said, we're just continuing what we were doing before. That means the pre-status quo, post-2017, approval of new PBTs was happening. It will happen under this rule. The terms of the rule don't prevent that. My friend couldn't answer your question, Judge Bumate. They will allow, this rule allows PBTs with some exposure, even though EPA has said that exposure to PBTs is risky. That means that they're going to allow risky PBTs under the market. That's arbitrary. They know that those are risky. And the chemical industry is here because they want that. They've filed an amicus brief supporting that. And
there's a little bit of contradictory argument there, though. You're saying this codifies what they've been doing, but yet you haven't identified any time where they've allowed a PBT that has led to an exposure.
The scientific evidence by the experts is that PBTs eventually lead to exposure, just by the
but nature. Not through this an exemption, not an exempted PBT.
I mean,
do you understand the contradiction there? You're saying, well, this is codifying what they're doing. They're going to allow this to happen, which they've allowed to happen, but it's never happened.
I think the scientific evidence from our declarants is that any PBT will result in exposure. And so the last point I want to make is this has real stakes, real consequences. Our clients are Alaska Native women, Miss Jasmine Jemmawak, a young Native mother. She has children. She consumes the traditional foods that are being contaminated and poisoned. Fish, whale, seals. There is a real threat here. We know that the industry has abused and will continue to abuse this process. All we're asking for is a direction to the EPA to go back, explain exactly how this is going to work, because there is this mismatch between what they've said about exposures and what their rule allows. That's classically arbitrary. An opinion that says, you've said exposures are risky, your rule allows exposures, you've said an absence of information about exposures should lead to denial. That's not codified in the rule. That's narrow. It doesn't require grappling with the exact statutory contours. It doesn't require making a finding that all PBTs are risky. It just requires the agency to explain why it's not following its findings, why it's departed from its prior rulemaking precedents, and why it didn't respond to comments that pointed all this out. Again, I'll just note, we said in comments, hey, their exposures are risky. How are you allowing exposures? They didn't respond, and they don't deny they didn't respond. We pointed to their prior rulemakings. There's nowhere in the record where they responded to their prior rulemakings. rulemakings and attempted to distinguish what they did here from those prior rulemakings. And as to PFAS, again, my friend on the other side said these are totally different. But if you look in the rulemaking record at what EPA said for PFAS, I think this is at 16 and 17, it said, we can't universally say all PFAS don't present an unreasonable risk, but we're still excluding them. That's what they said for PBTs. They said, we're making a general finding. Most of these shouldn't apply. We're excluding them for PFAS. They said the same thing for PBTs. They said, most of these shouldn't qualify for an exemption, but we're not excluding PBTs. They can't explain this irrational record. You can write a narrow crafted opinion that remands to them to get it right. And if you just make those findings, we're confident that if EPA means what it says here, then in processing these individual applications in the interim period while that remand is ongoing, that they will follow this court's opinion. And that gives us the safeguards we need. You don't need to address the contested remedy issue. I think that with that, I'm happy.
You're saying we could do that without vacating the rule?
Absolutely. We don't need vacater in that context.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, and Ms. Rabinowitz, you have, I think, 2.5 minutes or some, like 2:25.
Three quick points I'd like to make. First, the proposed notice here did not narrow the scope of the rulemaking in the way that EPA is now arguing. The notice said that they were going to conform the rules to the 2016 TSCA amendments. The 2016 amendments required that all notices be publicly available. They're hidden behind a database, and they are not. The second point is they want us to get on a hamster wheel of they didn't consider it in this rulemaking. We should file a petition for rulemaking. If we file a petition and they deny it, then the procedure and the scope of what we have to go to the district court, the scope of what the district court can do, whether it consider that de novo, is actually currently pending before the Ninth Circuit in a case called Food and Water Watch versus EPA. It involves fluoride and a decision that Judge Chen of the Northern District of California made. We would have to try de novo the question of what the right would be. If the judge went against us, we'd be back before this court probably 3 years from now, who knows when, with exactly the same argument. And to enforce a statutory right to information, we should not have to go through all those hoops. And finally, if EPA was concerned that the comments the union provided weren't directly addressed in their notice, at least in one other case involving asbestos, they published a supplemental notice saying, we learned something during the comment period and we'd like people to respond to it so we can move forward with a final rule. They could have done that in this case and had a quick mini proceeding that would allow the industry to respond specifically to any suggestions that the union had made that the EPA thought did not have adequate notice, and they didn't do that. And they have nothing on their regulatory agenda that would suggest they're trying to remedy this problem at any point in the future.
All right, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your arguments in this matter. This case will stand submitted. And I believe this concludes our calendar in Alaska for this week. And thank you for the hospitality that everyone has shown the judges here. And we've enjoyed visiting Alaska. Thank you.